If I ever hear the one time at Bandcamp line again, dot, dot, dot.
Yep. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Bandwagon Podcast for the week of April 15th, 2024. On this edition of the program, news and notes from the band world, including a storied marching organization comes to a sad end. The West Virginia University band practice facility story takes a turn, and then another. I'm asking about your graduation or commencement band experiences. And my conversation of the week is with someone who, among other things, has written for the Smithsonian Magazine. I'm your host, Rob Hamerton. Hello, dear listener. You may want to pull down the safety harness before you listen to this episode. I had it all planned out, and then stuff happened, and this week's podcast has turned into one that's full of stories with a frown. One of them doesn't have a happy ending. One of them does. One of them is actually my conversation with a relatively new band friend, and we talk about those exasperating ways that people outside a band think of people inside the band activity. And one of the stories is, well, not quite so frowny, but a follow-up to the story of the Auburn University band and which of its leadership team stayed on task. In that story from two episodes ago, I said I wished I knew who that on-task band leader was. Thanks to a gentle hint from a kindly source, I now know. So, that's something good anyway. I know, you're thinking, great, I'm going to listen to Rob Kvetch for 45 minutes. Not really. I'll keep it light, keep it bright, keep it, hey, let's play the first strain. In this episode's first strain, news and notes from the band world. Dateline, Erie, Pennsylvania. On the 2nd of April, Cadets Arts and Entertainment, or CAE, filed for voluntary Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection in the United States Bankruptcy Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Many of you will recognize CAE as the parent organization of the storied drum and bugle corps, the Cadets, who have also been known as the Cadets of Bergen County, the Garfield Cadets, and the Holy Name Cadets throughout their 90-year history. They began as a church-sponsored drum corps in Garfield, New Jersey, and more recently have been headquartered in Allentown and Erie, Pennsylvania. According to a press release from CAE, the bankruptcy filing was made largely as a result of a sexual abuse lawsuit that had been filed in September of 2020. CAE's insurance carrier rejected their request to provide coverage to fund defense costs. CAE found it financially impossible to continue defending the case. Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection provides for the sale of a company's assets to pay creditors and usually leads to liquidation. This has all led to the decision to end CAE and the Cadets program, meaning that the Cadets will not return to the marching arts competition field again, ever. The Cadets had already announced this past October that they would not compete this coming summer due to unmet fundraising goals. Cadets alumni volunteers will continue coordinating alumni social activities, and the Cadets Hall of Fame process will resume in 2025. All legacy and historical items of the Corps have been placed with the Marching Pageantry Arts Museum in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, for the time being. This is not a simple story. Part of this story is what I've just reported, the immediate effects of one specific allegation and lawsuit against the Cadets organization. Part of this story is that of an internationally renowned drum corps whose on-field performances contributed to revolutionary creative changes in the marching arts, both for drum corps and for marching bands. Part of this story is the reorganization of the Cadets' parent company and its board of directors several years ago, following numerous sexual misconduct allegations brought against longtime Cadets' corps director George Hopkins. It is the very definition of the phrase, it's complicated. Another part of this story is the huge number of Cadets' alumni, many of whom I know personally, many of whose expressions of regret and disappointment and, yes, grief about this development I have read on my social media feed this month. Those writings have inspired me to try to imagine what it would be like if an organization that meant as much to me as the Cadets mean to them folded, ceased operations, never to be experienced by audiences or participants or alumni again. Many of those people's thoughts acknowledged the effects that the Cadets' experience had had on their lives, the positive ones, life lessons learned, friends made and kept, professional connections built, but also the negative ones, specifically the effects on the lives of people who say they were mistreated during their Cadets' experience. That part of the story is not unique to the cadets. There are a number of other DCI member corps who have needed to confront the abusive behavior of past members and staff with varying degrees of success. And it's not unique to the marching arts world. Most notably, a decade or so ago, the Ohio State Marching Band had to deal with revelations of a toxic culture supported by its current membership and its alumni community. This topic is not going to be settled as part of this one single cadet story. It's a discussion that will necessarily and rightly continue beyond this moment. But in this moment, there are a great many different thoughts banging around in the heads of thousands of people who marched with the cadets and of yet more people who enjoy the cadets' performances. And I have nothing but respect and sympathy for all of them. Thoughts and prayers, indeed. It's a tough one, and it's not going to just disappear, even as the cadets' competitive days seem to have done. That's news and notes from the band world for this week. If you have a news item that you think should be included in this segment, send me a link via email to heybandwagon@yahoo.com. More Bandwagon in a moment. It's the second strain coming up next, but by way of introduction, I have, I don't know, a disclaimer maybe? Or at least a footnote of my own. In spite of my journalism major background, which includes the understanding that if it bleeds, it leads, or put another way, they never put gentle good news on the top of the front page because it don't sell papers. My plan was to use this segment of the podcast to report on as much good band news as possible. So I've included mentions of Allstate appearances and Sudler trophies and wealthy benefactors deciding to fund band equipment rooms instead of nefarious, murky political machinations, that sort of thing. Positivity. Because, well, there are enough podcasts that report on the news, nearly all of which these days is less than uplifting, partly because of the bleeding and leading rule and partly because it just is. That's the intro to the intro. You may recall that in episode 3 back on March 11th, I reported on a bit of controversy that had arisen surrounding the planning of a new practice facility for the West Virginia University Band. At the time, I braced myself because I felt as if I was being a little more 60 minutes about it than yay band. There were alumni contribution questions, there was the original plan to build the facility in this location that had suddenly changed to that location. I wondered if I was being too negative about what ought to be a happy occasion. I wondered if I was misinterpreting the details included in the local reporting. I wondered if I was just missing something, since sometimes I can be slow on the uptake when it comes to stories like this. And I really wondered if maybe there were going to be some more details emerging that would shed more light on the story, so maybe I should wait on this? Oh, my friends. Not only should I not have worried about any of that, but oh yes, more details have emerged. And with my newfound confidence in my ability to read tea leaves, I will suggest to you that this story didn't get any better. And then, at the 11th hour, suddenly it did seem to get better. Until that very last sudden development, though, this story was not at all a positive one, and so why was I chasing it, given the original intent of the podcast? Because one of my other goals for this project was to help create a community for and to offer support to band members. And this story is a chance to do that in the context of our mighty First Amendment. Buckle up. Here we go. Let's take the second strain. As promised, a follow-up to the story originally presented in this space about a month ago about the process of creating a new practice facility for the West Virginia University Mountaineer Marching Band. Great credit to the investigative journalists at a publication called The Vernissage Magazine. And I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm hoping it's actually The Vernissage Magazine, because one of my pet peeves is the anglicization of perfectly beautiful-sounding French words. But either way, the curious detail about this online magazine is it's a literary magazine born out of a mid-COVID pandemic discussion among alumni of Bethel Park High School in Pennsylvania. At heart, it's a poetry magazine. But the Vernissage Magazine editors heard about the West Virginia University Band facility story, and they decided it was worth becoming investigative journalists. And boy, did they hit that out of the park. So this summary is drawn from their reporting, and a major tip of the hat to them. To review, in October 2021, West Virginia University broke ground for a new state-of-the-art on-campus band practice complex. It was the final result of years of fundraising by WVU band alumni and friends. Phase one of the project was meant to be located on the site of WVU's former baseball stadium, Hawley Field, by fall of 2022. But construction never began. Then, this past autumn, band members and alumni were told that instead, the facility would be built at Milan Park, a privately owned community recreation complex nearly 5 miles away from campus. Student members of the band were concerned about traveling to the off-campus location. Alumni and donors felt betrayed by the move, calling the change a classic bait-and-switch. In describing where this story went next, I'll suggest that it's become a tale of two important topics: the suppression of free speech and the hiding of information, and the effectiveness of free speech when it is exercised. And this is still a banned podcast? Yes, it is, I promise. A number of documents obtained via Freedom of Information Act requests show that, in fact, since the middle of last year, Dean of the WVU College of Creative Arts, Keith Jackson, and several university administrators, and a WVU Foundation staff member, and members of the Monongahela County Commission conspired to instead use the $1.25 million in donated funds to build an artificial turf football field that Milan Park has wanted for a long time but has been unable to finance themselves. Two of those university administrators, the athletic director and the director of local affairs, hold seats on the Milan Park Foundation's board of directors. The Monongahela County Commission president, Tom Bloom, was a snare drummer with the WVU band. The plot gets thick. Even while emphasizing the on-campus nature of the project, university officials still actively solicited contributions, fully aware that the money would be used to benefit Milan Park instead. One alumnus wrote, quote, "I'm genuinely curious how this doesn't go against IRS regulations regarding restricted use of donor funds." Another wrote, quote, "I find it suspect that a county commissioner brokered a deal for alumni-donated money to go toward a county project." County Commission President Bloom's attempts to explain his actions on WVU alumni band social media met with such anger that the group's administrator deleted the initial comment threads. And, in a text message exchange with one other band alum, Bloom said, quote, "The pride of West Virginia is paying for the new Milan Park field. You can complain all you want." In an email to Dean Jackson, Bloom complained about some of the donors who had engaged him on online chat rooms, calling them, quote, "entitled Karens," and suggesting that their giving records ought to be looked into. Jackson responded by indicating that the College of Creative Arts had indeed done so and found that the complainers were all small-amount donors, perhaps implying that they really deserved less say in the matter. A brief editorial comment from me: money is speech, y'all. The Citizens United Supreme Court decision from 2010 says so. The sarcasm light has been turned on. Anywho, back to the story, and here's the part about suppression of free speech that I was talking about earlier. Shortly after the homecoming 2023 announcement of the new Milan Park plan, the WVU student newspaper published an article about it with interviews of band members. Many of those members expressed worry about the effects of distance and lack of transportation on the band's future. One said that they'd heard some underclassmen question whether they would return to the band for that reason. At the next home football game after homecoming, one band alumni donor talked to some current band members and was told that students were no longer permitted to speak publicly about it. Band section leaders had been instructed by band office staff to keep their sections from speaking out negatively about the Milan Park plan. And a WVU campus source said that band members had been threatened into silence, with the implication that adverse action would be taken against any who spoke out. For the record, instances of band members being forbidden from speaking out does constitute a violation of West Virginia state law, which explicitly protects free speech on state college campuses and provides recourse to students whose rights are violated. Now, Vernissage magazine, remember them? They had planned a 6-part series of articles about the band practice facility plan. 5 of the articles had been published when news broke. On March 25th, West Virginia University released an announcement from which I will read excerpts. West Virginia University has identified the Medfields located on the Health Sciences campus as the best on-campus option for the Pride practice field and facility being developed for the Mountaineer Marching Band. Quote, "The convenient location next to the Health Sciences Center PRT station, which was not previously available due to potential development plans, addresses transportation concerns related to an off-campus site, as well as potential pedestrian safety issues associated with crossing Monongahela Boulevard to reach the former Hawley Field location," said Keith Jackson, dean of the College of Creative Arts. "The site also already features lighting, and the band will have priority access to the Medfields and ample parking in the adjacent parking lots," unquote. The university renewed efforts to identify a suitable on-campus site after an October announcement outlining plans to shift the project to Milan Park generated concern among some stakeholders. Jackson said he understands the frustration as the efforts to create a Pride practice field and facility, which began nearly 5 years ago, have taken longer than expected. Quote, "The needs for all involved have evolved during that time, but our shared vision for the project and the commitment to our students and completing this project remain unchanged," Jackson said. "The University Planning Committee has approved use of the site, and the architect already involved in the project has been re-engaged to design a field with the same amenities originally included in the first and future phases of the project. The new site will accommodate the planned turf field, storage facility, and shelter. It is anticipated the process to complete a new design and gather cost estimates could be finalized in the next 6 months. Then, a request for procurement for construction will be issued, and site work will take several more months. The goal is for the turf field to be ready for the band to begin using the site by August 2025. Past and future donations will be used as originally intended, to fund the turf field, which will still be known as Don Wilcox Field, as well as other needs that will enable the band to practice at its new on-campus home. No gifts held at the foundation or funds from the university were transferred to Milan Park in support of this project. So, what can we make of all this? Several things, I think. One, investigative journalism is good. Word gets out, people learn things they wouldn't have known otherwise, because perhaps some other people would have preferred that they didn't know those things. Two, transparency is good, especially when it comes to money being donated for a particular purpose. It's good to be certain that your money is being used in the way you intended. Three, free speech is good, and suppression of free speech is bad, especially when it's the free speech of people about matters that will impact their lives in some way. In the case of the band practice facility story, these ideas about the free speech of people are especially true when those people are band members, student band members, who some government and university bigwigs seem to see as, at best, too small to care about, and, at worst, an actual impediment to their goals, goals which will impact and benefit their lives more. And four, large organization press releases are a joy to read, at least when it's abundantly clear that the large organization is backtracking furiously, trying to put a positive spin on what is plainly a desperate bid to make it sound like they have the best interests of everyone involved firmly in mind. Yeah, we see you. And we're paying attention now. And the large organization now knows that it's being scrutinized, thanks to, of all things, a poetry magazine. And maybe, just maybe, the Pride of West Virginia will finally get a proper on-campus rehearsal site that's not a parking lot. And maybe, just maybe, the band members, the little guys, will get the facility they deserve, one that they don't need to hop a bus to get to. Get your own darn football field. More Bandwagon in a moment. Okay, let's modulate and get into the trio section. This week in the trio section, my conversation partner this week seems, at least in my experience, to be someone who is heavily into creating projects for herself. Some of the listeners here who are UMass band alumni may have been involved in the research she did for a project she dreamed up some time ago, and that project led to a resume item that not terribly many people get to have or talk about, and I imagine we might talk about that a little bit today. But as we got preparing for this week's conversation, she leapt to the mighty Facebook and offered some folks the opportunity to contribute ideas we could talk about. This is an enterprising someone, and let's just get to it. Please help me welcome to the podcast Alexa Nicandros. Hello, Alexa.
Hey, Rob. How's it going?
I'm well, and I'm glad that you were willing to come and do this.
Of course. My pleasure.
A brief Google search of your name brings up a whole lot of really interesting biography items and activities, and I look forward to getting to all that and more. But first, let's start this conversation, as we always do now, with a few lightning round band questions. First, what's your primary instrument?
The tenor saxophone.
And over here, I'm doing a little happy tenor saxophone dance.
Whoop, whoop.
Do you currently have a band-related role?
Yes, I am in two community bands here on the Cape. I'm in the Cape Cod Concert Band, and I'm in the Brewster Band, of which I am the secretary.
So, which dovetails neatly into what bands have you been active with in your life, whether it's playing or doing anything else?
So, when I was in middle school, I started band, beginner's band and concert band. And then in high school, I did concert band, jazz band, marching band, winter percussion. I feel like I might be missing one. Took some music theory, if that counts. skipping right to UMass Amherst, I was in the concert band there, where I usually actually played the Barry sax and the bass clarinet. And I was in the hoop band and obviously the marching band.
I have already done a conversation with Zoe Stinson, who is all over the baritone sax. We got chatting a little bit about gender norms as it relates to what instrument various people pick up. I'm bumping into a lot of people who, a lot of women who play baritone sax, and I've been trying to figure out, did band directors push them toward that for some reason? I don't know. It's of interest to me, but I haven't done actual research on it.
Well, for me, I just really enjoy playing bass lines. I'm not somebody who is huge on like improv, and I really just like to play the music that's put in front of me. I don't even really practice in my free time at all. It's a more fun instrument, in my opinion.
How did you get into playing your band instrument?
My first instrument was actually the clarinet that I started in fifth grade. And I remember the music director of the school, he did a demo in the auditorium with everybody who was in fourth grade in preparation for the next year. And he demoed all the instruments. Me and my best friend, Mackenzie, we were sitting there and we wanted to play the same instrument together. And when the clarinet was demoed, Mr. Ponte, the band director, hey, Mr. Ponte, if you're listening, he played the Pink Panther theme. And that's what got me hooked on the clarinet. And then when it got to high school, my freshman year, I continued with the clarinet, but then I joined jazz band. And Mr. Ponte also was the director of the jazz band. And he said he didn't need a clarinet in jazz band. He needed a tenor saxophone. And so he kind of pushed me to switch to tenor. From there, I carried on with the tenor. And it's an easy switch to go from clarinet to saxophone. Not as easy to go backwards, though. It's a lot easier and more fun to play the saxophone than the clarinet, for sure. But I just carried on with that. And I don't remember why I picked up the Barry. I think we needed one in concert band, so I decided to play that. I liked the idea of just switching instruments a bunch. I thought it was cool. And when I went to UMass, they didn't march Barry, so I purchased a tenor, and that's where I've been.
As noted previously in our chat, you have that resume, Adam, which I find really cool, being somebody who is also interested in writing on top of all this other band stuff that I do quite a bit. But I want to make sure I get this right. You had an article published in the Smithsonian Folk Life and Cultural Heritage magazine.
I sure did.
And the title was somewhere along the lines of...
Band Kids Never Grow Up.
There we are. How did that project come about?
Well, it was pandemic times, and I wasn't working, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. So I was looking into internships with the Smithsonian, the field of working in a museum or some capacity in a museum. Seemed really along the lines of what I wanted to do. And I came across the internships at the Smithsonian, and I applied to a bunch of them, and that's the one I got. So it was all on Zoom. I think these days you actually go to Washington and stay there for the duration of the internship. But we met once a week with our little writing group. I don't remember how many of us there were, maybe 20, but not everybody was there every time. And we would pretty much have these discussions. We'd go around the room and people would talk about the ideas that they had for their next articles. It just got me thinking about like what aspect of culture is really, you know, accessible to me for me to actually, you know, research and write about. You know, band was the biggest thing for me. And I thought it would be really cool to kind of just show that, you know, it's not just band kids. And that's the only thought that go through people's heads when they think of band from the outside. You know, I thought it would be really cool to kind of show that this is a whole subculture.
A quote that leapt out at me pretty early in the article is you were describing how you had just after graduating from UMass joined the Florence Community Band, which is outside of Northampton, if I'm not mistaken. Something like either the second or third paragraph you get right to at the band's holiday band banquet, I surveyed the room full of my bandmates boogieing and goofing around, and I thought, wow, band kids never grow up. These were the same people I had marched with, only masked with gray hair and wrinkled cheeks. Despite the effects of time, the band spirit still bound them together, securing a home there through the years. Which, of course, kicked loose the title of the piece, but that strikes me as accurate. Community bands and bands involving people who are beyond age 21, 22, don't seem, it's true, to get nearly as much airtime, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I didn't even know about community bands until I graduated, and I don't even remember who told me about them. It might have been TTA, actually, who told me about the Florence Community Band.
Within the last year or year and a half, I've gotten involved with the community band. And once I did, I started to think, okay, well, let's look up community bands in Massachusetts. And I Googled that. Massachusetts is littered with them. Central Massachusetts, you walk five steps and you trip over another one, it seems.
In every town on the Cape.
And I considered myself a band person, but I had no idea. I wonder what your first impressions of the community band were when you got into it with respect to, I'm thinking of demographics, but I wondered what your first impressions were.
That I'm the youngest one there. I'm the youngest one in every community band that I've been in, unless there's a random high schooler there for the summer who is going back to school. It just needs a community service gig for the summer or, something like that. But yeah, I'm the youngest person in both the bands I'm in right now. Everybody is, the majority of people are probably in their 60s.
True. If you go on a YouTube and you search for community bands, you'll get, generally speaking, they look a lot like church choirs, which I'm also involved with.
Sure. Yeah. And the Brewster band I'm in right now, we just had someone retire from the band. He was the oldest member of the band. He is 102 years old. So oh, yeah. God bless him, Carl. Mm-hmm. He's still playing in a couple other bands, but he's gradually leaving them as he's, 102. Oh. But he played the alto, still plays the alto.
Famously, you can only play football for so long before your bod gives out, but you could be in band until you're 102. Look at that.
Yeah. And it's a great exercise for your brain. It's pretty much like knowing another language. Playing an instrument. That's how I think about it a lot, actually, is I can read another language and interpret another language. Sometimes I think about, as I'm sitting in band, if a complete stranger walked in with no band experience, if they would even understand anything that the band director was even saying.
Band seems an activity that the people who don't understand it feel a little bit more comfortable about advancing to mockery.
In a way, I honestly wouldn't say that. I would think whenever I tell people that I'm in band, I don't feel as though anyone is laughing at me. Mm-hmm. I think that they truly do not understand. They're just really ignorant to it. And it's not their fault, probably. Mm-hmm.
Another quote that I'm going to go to from the article in the Smithsonian struck me at the time and strikes me now as applicable to this conversation. In that moment, and you were describing going back to homecoming at UMass, generations blend together, and I'm suspended in time, shoulder to shoulder with current and former members I have never met. But everyone knows exactly what to do. Everyone knows that old family recipe by heart. From the outside, it's all odd. From the inside, there's a certain amount of security in knowing that the people next to you, you don't have to explain yourself to them.
Well, there's definitely some stereotypes from within the band as well, which mm-hmm. is really interesting to me. And the UMass marching band, for example, there are 400 of us, mm-hmm. and I did not know everybody, not even close. And we were, even though we were one band and acted as one band, and we all respected and loved each other and supported each other, we still remained pretty separated. I've heard before that the altos and the tenors, the saxophones used to be kind of one section until the tenor saxes gained so many members that we got our own bus all of a sudden. We became a little separated from the altos. And at one point, the altos were saying, the saxes are one section. Like the tenors were like, no, we're good. We'll be the tenors. You guys can do your alto thing. So we were always kind of like nervous on the bus. We had extra seats on our bus because we still had a small section. It was pretty cool. We had like our own row, all of us. But we'd get the overflow altos. And we were always just like, which altos are going to be on the bus with us today? I hope it's the cool ones. Like we're, And there are certain sections in the band that we didn't associate with at all. Like, I don't think I really came in contact with anybody from the color guard. And the flutes, for example, I don't think I was really close to anybody in the flute section. You end up kind of being closer to the people you end up marching next to, which is interesting too. And obviously, the drum line was pretty much an entire separate band. They had their own fraternity, they had their own traditions, they rehearsed in a separate space. They were intimidating also. They were intimidating.
With regard to the drumline, it was understood that they had different rehearsal requirements. There was a lot more repetition that they had to get into, and they needed to get their own acts together so that they could then be super competent when they got to us, the brass and woodwinds. But it did separate us out to the point that my senior year, we had an off weekend. It was late in the season, and somebody came up with the idea of let's have a band touch football game, but let's have it band versus drumline. Three things. One, it was snowing, so we played it in 3 inches of snow or four out there on the practice fields, and that was tons of fun without proper foot gear. The second thing I remember was that they had the drum majors be referees, and so I and one of my drum major colleagues were out there trying to make peace between everybody. But the most important thing that I remember was that there were a number of us that were saying, drumline is part of the band, is it not? And so fast forward a few years, and then a few years more, and then a few years more, when I got to be the director of the Holy Cross Band, when I arrived, the title of the group was the Holy Cross Crusader Good Time Marching Band and Color Guard. Part of that was because the Color Guard had administrative and budget oversight from a different department, but they had always been called that. And I remember thinking, the first thing I'm going to change, I'm going to do it quietly, but the first thing I'm going to change starting next year is that it's just going to be called the Holy Cross Crusader Band. And I talked to the color guard people and said, this is what I want to do. And they said, oh, good. Oh, thank you. So, so in the world of sections being kind of separated out from each other, yeah, I hear that 100%. All this talk of inside jokes and stereotypes in a good way, and understandings from within the band gets me deftly to the little micro project that you undertook kind of in preparation for this little chat today. We went onto Facebook and visited the UMass Band Alumni Facebook group page, and you asked them a question.
I did, yes. Pretty much, I asked if there were any band misnomers or stereotypes from the inside or the outside of band. We did already kind of touch on the ones from the inside. I got a couple good responses. A few of them I'm not even gonna really begin to bring up because they're a whole other realm of conversation.
Oh, they are. We're thinking of one, aren't
So
we?
yeah. So we got one. For what instrument do you play? Common response to people who play mellophone is mellophone, what's that? Is it like a xylophone? And this person also says, if I ever hear the one time at band camp line again, dot dot dot. Tim Anderson says that people are often surprised that he teaches other classes and doesn't just do band all day. Honestly, I thought he did do band all day, so I
In the time when I was looking for my first teaching job, I remember being very disappointed that the band director job also included this other and this other and this other and this other. Never mind the admin that goes with it, but I just, yeah, band all day would be okay with me, but it's not at all the reality, and nobody gets that.
Yeah, that's it's like when people think their teachers sleep at school.
Yes.
Someone says, I can still guess what instrument people played in marching band based on their personality.
I'm reminded, as our regular faithful listeners are, that last week there was an interview wherein a story was told about band camp roommates and how assumptions were made by the trumpet player about the flute player and the flute player about the trumpet player, and everything turned out well and stereotypes were dispelled and such. But it is absolutely it's part of the game.
Yeah, but it even carries over to concert bands too. Like there's references in the concert community bands I'm in now where people are 60, 70 years old, and we've got this elderly clarinet player who makes jokes about not wanting to sit next to the trumpets like frequently.
And some of those back and forths are, as your article definitely suggests, they're very much like infighting within a family where the members of the family perfectly well know that they love each other dearly and they would do anything for each other, but the sniping happens or the joking happens, and two things can be true at once.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we've spent a little time here quite clearly, picking apart the local traditions of the local Amherst campus band that we know rather well. And I certainly imagine that there are podcast listeners out there who are from that tradition, but also other bands' traditions and whatnot. And I can imagine that they might contribute stereotypes and misconceptions and misnomers from their own experience. And we could do a follow-up session or even have it become a regular feature. They, of course, can do that by leaving an email or a voicemail, and I can tell you all how to do that during the end credits. But I have so enjoyed this conversation, both from the perspective of dredging up fun memories and hearing yours, because we're of the same organization but different eras. And stuff evolves and stuff develops, and some things hang on and other things don't. And it's interesting to see the organic way that things move from one place to another. And yet details change, but we all understand the basic joke. But before we wrap this all the way up, Alexa, I'd like to offer you some slightly less strictly resume-based lightning round band questions to ponder. What's one of your favorite pieces of band music that you've played, outdoors or indoors?
There's been so many, and a lot of them I can like feel in my soul, but don't really remember what they were called. Especially like in high school concert band, there was something different about high school concert band because we would have four pieces and we would work on them every single day. And we really got to know them. And I don't think that I've really had that close relationship with a piece like since then, really. Especially because when I was in marching band, I was totally incapable of memorizing my music. I just couldn't do it. I never once played a song all the way through from memory, ever. Couldn't do it. So I'm going to base this more or less off the best performance or field show that I had at UMass. That would be my freshman year. Maybe it was just because it was fresh and new and exciting. I don't know, but playing that Earth, Wind, and Fire medley, sometimes I just watch it on YouTube because it like gives me chills, like with that company front at the end. Like that was probably the most powerful marching band moment that I ever experienced.
If it's the one I'm thinking of, it's the one that was taken to Penn State.
Yes.
Yep. Which is on YouTube, and we shall stick that link in the show notes because people need to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really, really love playing marches. I do. I really like playing marches. They're fun. They're upbeat. They're just difficult enough to like keep you alive. We play a good amount of John Philip Sousa and the Brewster Band, and we always end with Stars and Stripes. Even for Christmas, we do a Stars and Stripes to end with. It's like a jingle. It's Jingle Bells Forever. It's really fun.
I know it well. Yep. And bandos connect in a different way. Look at that. Is there a piece of band music that you haven't played but you would like to?
Honestly, there isn't much that, you know, I'm like, we need to. There were some when I was in hoop band at UMass because we just did short snippets of songs. I usually ask TTA if someone could arrange this song or that song. I really wanted to play like Mambo Number 5 by Lou Bega. I think I did suggest playing the William Tell Overture this year in the Brewster Band, and they added it. So we have a folder that's like more than an inch thick of music for the Brewster Band. It's crazy. We have so much music.
But that one worked out.
Yes. Yep. They added that this year just for me.
Is there a band that you would like to perform with that you haven't, either because you're not the right age or you're not in the right place or you don't live in the right time?
I would love to do jazz band again. I have heard of a couple people alluding to me that I could be a good fit in a jazz band. Only one that would give me the music to read because I just can't. I don't have the brain to improvise. I have no problem soloing, but if it's written.
I love playing second tenor.
Yeah, there you go. When I was in Northampton, I was actually in a band called the Expandable Brass Band. And we were kind of like a New Orleans style, like street band. So we did parades and stuff, but we didn't march. And we kind of just popped up in places and just played stuff for people. And we dressed in like in yellow and black colors. And we were pretty goofy. And that was kind of an in-between, like a non-serious marching band. And that sort of thing would be really fun to do again, too.
Have you got a favorite band story you would like to tell?
They all blur together, honestly. So there's kind of snippets of stuff, but I don't know if anybody listening remembers the Plymouth Parade, the Plymouth Thanksgiving Day Parade. What year was that? I feel like it was 2015, 2016, but that was the worst day ever. The end, though, may like we were feeling really good by the end. What happened was we all met at the band building, and it was Thanksgiving weekend, so some people weren't coming back on the bus to campus. Some people were just driving there and then driving home after. So like it wasn't like a you have to get on the bus and you have to come back on the bus. It was kind of a free-for-all situation. For anybody listening who doesn't know this, the UMass marching band needs 8 buses to get around, plus a vehicle to transport the equipment. That day, two of the buses didn't show up. So we had people sitting in the aisle. We had people squishing into other seats. We had people driving in other people's cars to get to the Plymouth Parade. I think on the way there, another one of the buses broke down.
Because this is what happens, yes.
It might have caught on fire, if I remember
Oh.
correctly, like dead serious. Like there was a year where a bus caught on fire and I wasn't on that bus. I don't have clear factual evidence to provide for you, but it might have been that day. It might have been a different time. I don't know. But just for the sake of theatrics, let's say the bus caught on fire on the way to the Plymouth Parade that year. So then the people in that bus had to consolidate into another bus that was either behind or in front of them. And so now we were down a bunch of buses. Once we got to Plymouth, finally, because everybody's stuff was like mixed around and like on multiple different buses and multiple different cars and whatever, everybody, no one had their stuff with them anymore. And also, a lot of people weren't going back to the school on the buses. So they took everything off of all the buses. The equipment staff or this group of people spent like a couple hours just taking all of everyone's stuff off of the buses and putting them into piles according to the type of item they were in this field, like in the middle of Plymouth. And I remember there just being like a pile, like a line of shoes and a line of backpacks. Honestly, with how gray and sad and stressful that day was, to see everyone's stuff in lines according to type of item was just really weird.
A little bleak and stark.
A doomsday situation. Like, it was just one of those things that people don't really know, like what we go through as a collective band, but it is those things that really bring us together the most. So that was a long story. I apologize, but
No apology necessary because you are not the first person to have brought that story up in this series, but your perspective on it was different.
really? All right.
As you began, I thought, I'm not going to stop her because everybody's experience of the same event is different, and that's part of the fun too.
That's cool. Yeah.
And the last question, have you got a favorite band life lesson or bit of wisdom that you've found useful outside of band? You may have just done it for all I know.
Just band is for everyone is really the one that sticks in my head all the time. It's not just band that's for everyone. It's honestly like life is for everyone. Like I'm also an artist, and artists are very often suppressed and they struggle, especially with money and having time to actually create things. And like I just always think about how wonderful the world would be if we could just have all the time to just like create for joy. Bands for everyone, arts for everyone, life is for everyone.
Well, I do appreciate you taking time to not only come on this podcast, but to do some really serious prep for it. If someone listening to this wanted to find more about you and your projects, whatever they happen to be, music, art, whatever, where could they go online to do that?
At the moment, you can find me on my Instagram at a underscore Nick Kandros, and the name of my pottery business is Little House Ceramics.
And we will make sure to get links to those into the show notes so that people can come visit you if they like.
All right. Open door policy, everyone.
Musician, artist, teacher, if I'm not mistaken, of art classes and such. Lots of things.
Yep.
Alexa Nikandros, thank you for contributing mightily to this podcast. It was a ton of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Okay, we'll do one more grand pause and then take care of a couple of more little items. Thank you, my fine listener, for staying with me. Here comes the dogfight. This week's dogfight is another follow-up to a story included in a previous episode, in this case, episode 6 from April 1st. It was the story of Auburn beating Alabama in the Iron Bowl, and of the video that captured the response of the band in that moment. And of the response of his leadership, particularly the one drum major who led with a heart of fire but a head of ice. In that segment, you may recall that I said I didn't know that drum major's name or where she'd gotten to, but I hoped that some band somewhere was benefiting from her considerable band-related skills, whether she was a band director or staff instructor or what. I now know the answers to all those questions. Her name was and is Emily Gray. At the time of the Iron Bowl Kick 6 victory, she was a fifth-year senior majoring in music education. That Iron Bowl was her last regular season home game. She's currently director of percussion at Tuscaloosa County High School in Alabama. Now, I do think it's useful to make a couple of additions to the original story, partly in order to be fair to the Auburn band director, Dr. Corey Sperlin, whom I originally kind of painted as abandoning his post, which is not right, and partly to polish Miss Gray's reputation yet further. So, with help from the reporting of Outkick.com and the Opelika Auburn News, and those links and more are in this week's show notes, here's a bit of clarification. In an interview after the Iron Bowl, Gray said, quote, "We always just approach those events like business as usual. Obviously, with the Iron Bowl, there's just a certain level of intensity and just feverishness that comes with that game that doesn't come with any other." At Auburn University's football stadium, Jordan-Hare Stadium, the band is positioned on the end of the field where the kick returner fielded the kick. Alabama was attempting the field goal toward the Auburn band. So by the time the unsuccessful kick was returned for a touchdown in the opposite corner of the field, Gray could only see it all by watching on the video board, but once she knew the kick returner wasn't going to be caught, it was go time. Quoting her, "Looking down the field, you have no perspective, no relativity of where they are on the field. So I'm looking at the Jumbotron and I'm thinking, you've got daylight, a lot of room, a lot of daylight, so I go into game day mode. It's like, come on, you got to get up, got to get your horns up, got to get going, and then he scores the touchdown." Unfortunately, all the focus in the world was no match for the sound coming from the crowd at Jordan-Hare Stadium, so getting the band in order still required some improvisation. Quoting Miss Gray, "You've got a whistle, so normally you might give warning tweets, a quick tweet-tweet, so they know to respond by looking at you, getting whatever hand sign you put up, and then I tweet you off with the tempo of the tune, and then we're into the tune. Well, this is unlike any scenario we've ever had. I've done 5 years of band at this point, and in all those game scenarios, every single one of them, I've never had a stadium be that loud. So at this point, it's like, whistles? What whistles? Nobody can hear them. But luckily, the band knows as well as I do that it's their job to play, even when they're excited. So they see it, enough of them catch it that we can start playing, and from there on out, it's just crazy. Pandemonium." By the way, the roar of excitement from the crowd eventually registered on seismographs in Alabama. As Gray was looking for help signaling to her band of 380, she couldn't find a graduate teaching assistant or her band director. Corey Sperlin, that band director, later said in an interview with Fox Sports, quote, "I can't say that I've really seen anything like that before. Next fall," which would have been fall 2014, "will mark my 20th year being associated with an SEC band. This is my 8th year at Auburn and 20 years with some SEC band, and I can't say I've ever seen an ending to a game quite like that." Gray continued, "Dr. Sperlin's normally right on top of the drum major, and when I went back and watched the video, I was like, oh, that's why, because he would get to live the moment fully. It was such an awesome thing to see him be out of character, because normally all of our staff is just very stoic and very disciplined and very matter-of-fact, and in that moment to get to see them sort of let their hair down. And now you know
the rest of the story."
Okay, one last pause to catch our breath, and I mean that. Then we'll head for the goal line. Thanks for continuing to listen. For the code of this week, another call to action, y'all. We'll be right back. At this time of year, we in the band world are looking ahead to spring. For some of us, that means getting ready for summer concerts. For others, we're getting ready to bid graduating seniors a fond farewell from high school or college, and we're preparing our chops for renditions of Pomp and Circumstance, during which we'll probably take a lot of repeats. Here's my question for you, to which I'd love to have you reply, in the service of an episode in May, probably. Have you got a graduation or commencement band story you'd like to share? Or a story about a particular graduating band senior whom you've known, or whom you've been? It can be funny, it can be poignant, but whatever it is, I bet folks would love to hear it. Instructions for how you can do that? Well, they're littered all over this podcast, but also, I'll go back over them in 3, 2, 1. That's Bandwagon for this week. Thanks as always for downloading and listening. Bandwagon was written, researched, and produced by your humble host. Musical interludes were produced by Hammerton Media, from source material largely by John Philip Sousa. You can listen to more episodes at our website, heyband.podbean.com. Please give me feedback, be polite, but let me know what you like, what you think might change. Tell me your best band story, maybe about commencement band, or suggest a topic for a future episode, whatever you like. You can do that using our email address, heybandwagon@yahoo.com, or leave us a 90-second voice message by going to speakpipe.com/heybandwagon. Be aware that we do reserve the right to include your message on the podcast, unless you say otherwise. All those contact links and links to our news items, conversation topics, and my guest, Alexa Nicandros, can be found in our show notes. Please share the show on social media, and thank you for that. If you enjoy this podcast, get someone else to listen as well. Word of mouth really is the best recruiting tool. And to keep up with us every week, subscribe to Bandwagon on the Podbean app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people to find the show. For now, take care, stay in touch, stay in tune, and we'll do all this again next week. I'm Rob Hammerton. Detail, fall out.